Welcome to the Physics Teaching Podcast, a podcast for physics teachers made by teachers of physics, or the other way around, one of the two.
It's our first birthday, Robin. A year ago, we released episode zero, and then in a year ago and a week, we released the first ever episode, Balloons. So welcome. Happy birthday, us.
It's a happy birthday to us indeed. I know that it starts off, you know, the podcast, it's so small and helpless, and before you know it's walking and drinking from the toilet and all sorts of stuff. It's amazing, isn't it?
So my name is Thomas WP. I'm a part-time A-level physics teacher and also Year 7 science, and we're joined by Robin.
Yes, I'm a physics teacher all the way through from Year 8 to Year 13, and in loving being back in the classroom after a bit of a break working at the Institute of Physics. And we are joined by, I have to say, possibly one of the best-dressed physics teachers in the country. It's the winner of our T-shirt way back. Was that the first T-shirt we gave away, I think?
Yeah.
And when I say the first, it sounds like we've given away hundreds. We've given away two because we're cheap, let's face it. But the first one was to Mary Wilde. Welcome, Mary.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself, Mary? What sort of school you teach at and things like that?
Yeah, so I teach at a state secondary in West Sussex. So we only go up to GCSE, so it's Year 7 to Year 11 mixed school. And I have to teach all the sciences, obviously, but I do generally just teach physics at GCSE.
So welcome, Mary. Welcome on board. And Robin, you have some exciting news that you have a new title.
Yeah, I just heard today that I've just got the email back that, I've been elected as a fellow of the Institute of Physics, which is rather lovely. So I'm now an FInstP. So I was saying, oh, that's got to be worth a few decibels on the volume control. Surely I have to be louder than you all now. That's just, yeah. I won't let it change me, though.
I'm tugging my forelock right now. Tugging.
Yeah,
what hair's left?
Still going to be the same pillock I've always been. Don't worry.
Don't tell the IOP. Mind you worked there and they still gave you one, so you must have done something right.
Actually, that was the deal, wasn't it? Look, if you go, we'll make you a fellow, for goodness sake.
Well, congratulations. Anyway. Congratulations.
Thank you, yeah.
So, physics in the news. Mary, you said while we were getting ready that you had something up your sleeve, so tell us, what have you seen?
Oh, well, this week I just saw an article, and I don't know if it came out this week, it might be older, but it's about they've discovered, I think, how spiders fly, because previously they thought it was just on wind using those currents, but they think it's actually where they shoot the silk out to make their webs, it becomes negatively charged, and then because of all the thunderstorms in the atmosphere we get those charges as well, and so they use electrostatic repulsion to actually propel themselves around. So they basically float on electricity, which is quite exciting.
So that tickly feeling when you're walking across a field, walking through the garden on a summer's day of a spider web across your face, is really to do with static electricity?
Yeah, they're just basically giving you lots of mini electric shocks to say that you've destroyed my home, I'm going to shock you.
Zap. Wow, that's just brilliant, isn't it? So how do the spiders, I suppose with all their eight legs, they can, you know, get the duster and the plastic rod and really, you know, generate quite a lot of static that way. That's presumably how it goes, is it?
Heavy sigh. Spiders using static to repel themselves off the ground, is that right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's how I interpreted what I read.
Well, there is this thing, isn't it? Because they basically, when they're very, very, very tiny and they weigh practically nothing... The classic view, wasn't it, was that they span out a little web and it was picked by the wind and off they went. But of course, how did you avoid the web getting twisted? So presumably if it's statically charged all the way along, that sort of stops it from folding on itself at the very least, so that kind of helps. And then presumably you're right, you know, it's got the induction thing gets attracted to other things. I don't know, it's just, but it is fantastic, isn't it? What a great thing, what a great idea.
Bravo, spiders. I'd never really thought about why the web didn't tangle.
Yeah, I honestly don't know. But what a great story. Spiders and static electricity.
Is that how Spider-Man works? Because I thought it was little hooks on his hand.
Yeah, I think that's how they hang off the ceiling, isn't it? I don't think it's static electricity there. I don't think they don't like the balloon that you try and stick to the wall, which never sticks to the wall. Does everybody here get the balloon to stick to the wall?
Oh, the whiteboard, it does. Whiteboard, it sticks to very nicely.
Sticks to nearly everything. I love that experiment.
Well, it's all right for you. You've got hair.
Well, not so much anymore.
I try and rub it. It just makes a horrible squeaking noise, and all the kids go, ooh, ee, yay.
So let's move on. We had a really good audio diary from Charlie last week telling us about him being catching the board rubber in the corner of the room when it was thrown at him and his moving towards understanding physics. And this week he's posed us some questions. So let's have a listen.
Good afternoon, Physics Teaching Podcast. Charlie here. Just catching up with my reflections on recent lessons and some planning questions for my next lesson on Monday. First reflection, I had a lovely observation when we were looking at air resistance, water resistance and forces, where one of my students suggested a conundrum that she'd seen when swimming with her father, and that she'd been trying to push her beach ball to the bottom of the pool and had been unable to, and yet her father had been able to do that. Tremendous opportunity to observe mass, acceleration, but also the opportunity to look at water resistance and surface area, etc., etc. So the students really are coming on with their thinking and posing some really interesting and thoughtful observations. Moving on now, as the scheme continues, and my question for the Physics Teaching Podcast is, looking at forces at a distance, what's the best way to really get students understanding the difference between weight and mass? And also, how do we best teach the effect of gravitational forces on Earth and in space? Any thoughts would be gratefully received. Thank you.
Well, I'm going to let you two answer those.
Oh, thanks very much. Great. Mary, over to you.
Thank you. Well, I can tell you what I do in my mass and weight lesson. So the first thing I get them to do is we have a range of objects, and they get their mass from a balance, because they all know how to use a balance. And then they get the weight from a newton meter, because they all know how to use a newton meter, because we're in the topic on forces. And so the same object, and they've got two different numbers, and one is in kilograms, one's in newtons, and I get them to see the relationship between them, see if they can find the pattern. And of course, one is 10 times the other. And that's kind of how I lead into that value of 10, and this, and then what the definitions for mass and weight, what they actually are. So that's kind of how I start that lesson. I get them to find the pattern. And it, they always do. They can always see immediately it's 10 times different.
Is that a year 7 sort of lesson?
Yes.
I remember teaching mass and weight in exactly that way, and I got them to plot a graph, which obviously was proportional, and that gave them the relationship too, but probably it's a bit cognitively demanding thinking about it. But what I did as a wrinkle on that, I had in the corner of the lab, I called it a moonometer. So I had a picture of the moon stuck to the table, and I had a newton meter that I changed the scale on. So as an extension, once they could tell me that on Earth your weight is 10 times your mass, what was your weight on the moon? And so they take the same object over to the moonometer and weigh it and find out that it wasn't 10 times. And that sort of reinforced, nice. I felt, what you're saying, that the relationship between mass and weight.
That's nice. I like that. A moonometer. Very good. Yes.
There's two videos I like to show in that lesson. There's the one, the actual hammer and feather on the moon, the actual video that was taken when they dropped those. And then do you remember Adam Hart Davis? Did you ever watch any of his stuff? Mm-hmm. There's a where he goes up to the top of the Leaning Tower of Pisa and drops two tomatoes from there kind of mimic the thought experiment where they were saying if you drop cannonballs off of it. And so that's like my kind of... we talk about mass and weight, but it's a little bit of an extension to bring in the difference air resistance makes as well.
Yeah. No, that's nice, actually, because I think I bring it round from the idea of you know, we talk about a force being a push or a pull. And, you know, when we talk about, I say, you know, weight's a force because it's a pull, you know, it's a pull of the Earth. And then... So getting to think about what's being pulled on, and then it's a fairly short jump from there to mass. So, you know, that's kind of one of the things. And I do lean heavily on the whole space thing. They do get the idea that things, you know, aren't as heavy on the moon and things like that. And we talk about why that is. So that there's the space. And that video from Apollo 17, I think, wasn't it, that did the feather and the hammer, is quite good to look at as well, because that shows not only that they fall at the same rate, but also they fall much, that the acceleration is much less rapid, which you can clearly see on the video. They fall much more slowly to the moon than they would do on the Earth.
When you were talking about dropping tomatoes, Mary, I was reminded of an experiment which isn't mass and weight, but I just thought I'd share it because I love this. It's to do with air resistance and free fall. I might have been Adam Hart Davis or someone like that I saw doing it. And you drop a feather and it floats slowly to the top of the bench. You drop a textbook and it drops to the top of the bench, as you'd expect. And then you say, but if you take away air resistance, and you think, well, how can you do that without a vacuum? And you just put the feather on the back of the book and drop it. That takes air resistance. The feather just stays right on the book. It's a beautiful, simple demo of how air resistance affects things falling. It's really,
I like that.
Really, really beautiful. I wish I could remember where I got it from.
That's very good. Yeah, I like that. That's very good.
I would say we also covered mass and weight in episode 6, which is the trying to convert the rugby ball full of cement. So,
yes,
I'll just quickly run through that to stop people having to go back. So this is what I got from textbook years and years ago. I've probably got it kicking around my office. Yeah, Physics View, Keith Johnson. And Professor Messer kicks a rock on the moon and hurts his toe just as much as he does on the Earth. And I turn that into you'll have to listen to the podcast, but I turned it into a converting a rugby ball full of cement story. And the point is that you break your toe just as much trying to accelerate a mass as you do on the moon as you do on the Earth, because mass is how hard it is to accelerate something, and that's what mass is.
So when mine come into the room, I have on the board, would you rather be hit by a ton of bricks or a ton of feathers? Kind of think about that, how, you know, the mass is the same. Doesn't matter,
nice,
that,
yeah.
Feathers are nice and soft and small and light. If you've got a ton of them, it's still going to hurt.
Yes, it's going to hurt a bale of feathers. Yes. So, Robin, what about the best ways to teach forces at a distance, either gravity on Earth or in space? I'll leave that one to you. You've got the fellow. You're the fellow of the IOP. I'll let you handle that one.
I am. So the one they're most familiar with is magnets. So I always think magnets are really helpful on this, because they do. You can see that very clearly with you know, forces acting at a distance, and particularly the floating paperclip demo, I think, is really good. It's so simple, and instantly they all kind of know exactly what's going on. And they can tell you about the force. Oh, yeah, because it's the magnet that's holding the paperclip up. But, you know, and you can literally put a piece of paper in between the magnet and the paperclip so that they can see that there's no connection there. So these forces are definitely acting at a distance. So they get the idea that forces act at a distance. And then we can talk about things like the Earth. You know, you can hold a pendulum bob on a piece of string and say, yeah, the pendulum bob is still being pulled towards the Earth because the gravity is still acting on it, despite the fact that it's not in contact with the Earth. You don't have to be in contact with the Earth for gravity to be acting on you. You know, the International Space Station is orbiting because of gravity. All of these things are things that they kind of know about. So you can develop that idea of non-contact forces from there, I think. So magnets is where I start, because it is the most familiar and obvious and messable with, if you like. Give them a couple of magnets and you can say, okay, hold the two like poles together, what happens? They know it repels. Hold the two unlike poles together and they know it attracts, and they've seen all that, they're familiar with all that, so they get the idea of non-contact. So we say, yeah, okay, so some forces do not have to be in contact. Sorry, that's a rambling kind of thing, but that's where I start.
Yeah, I like magnets. I would also use a Van de Graaff, any excuse to use a Van de Graaff, because if you had the Van de Graaff and you know, you have the sphere on a string, on a wire that you can hold, you can feel a force, and I'll just get a few of them to hold that and bring it near to the vent, and you can feel it being pulled in.
Yes.
And that's a really nice non-contact force. And then you can put the stack of aluminium foil tart cases on the top, and then they fly in the air. and that's kind of an obvious non-contact force. So that I agree with you. I think you want to get across the idea of non-contact force, because they don't think of gravity as a non-contact force because they're in contact all the time, aren't they?
Well, this is it, but they do get the idea that even an aeroplane is acted on by gravity. If the engine stopped, it would be quite catastrophic because it would fall, and they know that. And so they know that even though the plane isn't in contact with the ground, there's still a force there. So the idea of non-contact force, you can develop that way, I think. And you, it's a really good idea to bring the Van de Graaff, because that's basically it. Is if you've got magnetism, you showed the magnetism acting at a distance, you showed them, or you've gone through the thought experiment of a plane crashing, you've said about gravity acting at a distance, and then you look at the Van de Graaff with the electrostatic force acting at a distance, and that's kind of it, isn't it, really?
I quite like doing the balloon with the water. To show that one, where you bend the water.
Nice.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah, so just for our non-specialist folks, the balloon and the water?
Well, you charge the balloon by rubbing it on your jumper, and then because water is a polar molecule, if you hold it near the stream of water, it will bend without you touching it.
Lovely. Beautiful. Yeah, no, it's a great demo, that, isn't it?
Yeah, so you want a trickle of water, don't you? You have a jet, it won't work, but a nice, gentle trickle of water out of those thin lab taps, and it will go all over the place if you get it right.
Beautiful. I always find it's a lovely extension as well when you're doing static with a class, and you give them the plastic rod, and then you give them the glass rod, and you say, you know, these charge oppositely. So predict, having used the plastic rods to attract the water and it bends towards your rod, what's the glass rod going to do? And they say, oh, it's going to bend away. And then, of course, it doesn't. It bends towards. And then you say, well, there you go. Work that one out. What do you reckon? You know, that's a nice extension.
Charlie asked also about forces in space.
Mm.
Now, I think there's a question he may well get asked that is tricky, which is kids always know you're weightless in space.
Yes.
So how do we help Charlie answer that question? But sir, in space you're weightless. You're still in the gravitational field. Anyone want to take that on?
Yeah, I never know this one, because I've heard people argue that you're weightless in that situation. I'd argue you're not weightless. You still got a weight, but you're just falling at the same rate as everything around you. You're free-falling.
That's exactly my argument.
Yeah, that's the one I usually use, but I'm not sure, because I've heard some people argue that that's, you know, not right, that you are effectively weightless, but...
I think it depends how you define weightless. I mean, if you took up some scales and were falling with them inside the space shuttle... Well, as was inside the International Space Station, and you tried to stand them, they would register no weight. Therefore, you are weightless. But in physical terms, you have weight, you are falling. And then you have to go down the rabbit hole of explaining why you're falling. It's a tricky one.
Mary, what do you reckon?
I'm just thinking about how I would explain this to a Year 7 if they asked me, because I'm not sure they have enough other knowledge to understand the reason why you're not weightless. So it might be one of the ones where you just have to go, do you know what? You just have to accept it for now and ask me the question again in 5 years' time.
Yes, maybe.
Yeah, I think I might do that. I might say, well, when you get to A-level, I'll explain why you're not weightless. But people think you're weightless because if you took up some bathroom scales and put them at your feet as you were orbiting the Earth, they would register no weight. But when you come back and do A-level physics, I'll explain it all to you properly.
It's such a cop-out, but sometimes they just... If they don't have enough other knowledge.
Yeah, so the dropping elevator is quite a good one. You know, the sort of thing that, you know, if you're in an elevator that loses the cable and starts to free fall, you know, should you jump when it's just about to hit the floor? Because that will that save you? You know, and that's a great sort of, you know, kind of year seven type of lesson. And the thing is, of course, no, because you'll be floating around inside the elevator as if you are weightless, because you'll be falling at the same rate as it. And so your net acceleration downwards will be zero. And then when it hits the deck, you're going to hit the deck as well. So
yes.
That's the end of it. So jumping won't help you, I'm afraid, kind of thing. But So the falling elevator perhaps is a way in. Maybe that's a way of saying, so all it is that you're falling at the same rate as the elevator, so you float around inside as if you're weightless. And, of course, you can look at the picture. You know, that's a great film when Stephen Hawking does the astronaut training plane, you know, the NASA plane that goes into the arc.
The vomit comet.
Dive. Is that what they call it, the vomit comet? You see him sort of floating around in there, and of course you just say he's accelerating downwards at the same rate as the plane, so he appears to be weightless.
Yeah, it is a bit of a rabbit hole, isn't it, though, especially with the S7. I think the cop-out might be the best option. I wondered also if Charlie's question was about explaining the gravity on the moon being less, which is also a challenging one, because then you've got to have the concept of, well, it depends how big the mass is, how hard it pulls on you, and the moon is smaller than the Earth. That's probably as far as I'd go with that. It's probably as far as I understand with that.
Yes. Well, it's a great question. There's a video, YouTube video somewhere, which somebody very kindly did the link to. I think I mentioned it before in the podcast, which is the when people are asked which is greater, the pull of the Earth on the moon or the pull of the moon on the Earth. And everybody says, oh, it's the pull of the Earth on the moon because, you know, that's the Earth's bigger and the moon smaller. And, yeah, that's why. And, of course, they're the same, the reaction forces. So it's equal and opposite. But most people get that wrong. Most people who've been all the way through, and this was an American video, so people who've been through high school and beyond and so on and so forth still get that wrong.
Well, that goes back to my jelly chair, doesn't it, episode 6 as well.
I think that was probably the episode we mentioned it, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. I'll try and dig it out. So I think hopefully we might have confused the issue for Charlie, but I will send in this audio as soon as we finish recording and we'll hear back from him next week. Now, this is your moment, Mary. Do you have, bong, a practical in memoriam for us?
Okay, so the practical, well, it's a demonstration actually I want to talk about. It's the one, I did it in my NQT year where it kind of made me realise what kind of teacher I was going to be. So I started teaching, this is my fifth year of teaching, so I started sort of around the time the new specs were coming in. So I was asked to write the lesson walkthroughs by my school for physics. So I had the textbook and I was going through. And when I got to the particle model section, there was a demonstration textbook for measuring the specific latent heat of fusion of ice. And I've got a master's degree in physics, and I looked at this and I thought, I don't remember that, but I'll have a go. And I set up this demonstration, and I'll talk you through it in a second, but the result I got was near perfect. And I thought, oh my gosh, I've just used classroom lab equipment, and it's come out with this value that's nearly dead on the actual real value. And I absolutely love maths, and my physics lessons are so based around maths. I get really excited about doing calculations and coming out the other end with these answers. So this one, you just melt crushed ice in a funnel and collect the water in a beaker underneath, which doesn't sound exciting, but you use a heater, an immersion heater, to heat the ice. Now, the first time I did this, I used a plastic funnel and I melted it and it stuck to the immersion heater. and I had to very sheepishly go to the technician, I'm really sorry, I think I've ruined this piece of equipment, please can I have another one with a glass funnel? She was very nice about it. But if you know the energy you're supplying to the heater, and you know the mass of that you've melted, of ice that you've melted, you can use your latent heat equation. And like I said, the value I got, it was so close. I repeated it 3 times because I couldn't believe how close I got. In fact, recently on Twitter, people were complaining about the specific heat capacity experiment, saying that was boring. And that's another one of my favourites, because if you do it properly, the values you get are so close. And I just find that really exciting, and it sounds really sad. But I just think it's great.
Not in the least.
In a classroom, you can get like real proper values for these things. They're not too out.
I've seen that one, but I've never done it, and I regret it, because it's ideal for just for A level. We do latent heat in A level, and I will endeavour to remember when I go through it again to use it.
Just use
it's
a
lovely.
Glass
I've only heard about it. I've only heard about it. Use a glass funnel. I've only heard about it. I've never tried it.
Yeah, no, same.
It takes about 20 minutes. So as a demonstration, you need something else going on at the same time, I think, because otherwise they're just staring at melting ice for 20 minutes. You know, they need to be doing something. But in terms of maths.
So just some details. Is the ice crushed or is it blocks? How big's the funnel?
Well, do you get different size funnels? We all our funnels are the same size.
So what, just a standard lab, a little funnel, sort of about 10 centimetres diameter?
Yeah. Yeah, and just fill it with crushed ice, only crushed so that it melts quicker. That's the only reason, really, because you weigh them, you get the mass of it before and after. So you do need to make sure that you do it without the heater first, so you know how much ice melts just due to room temperature, so you can subtract that.
Yes, that's a top tip. So do you do that with them or before?
I do that with them because that, you know, we talk about why we have to do that first.
I wouldn't have thought of that. That's obviously such a sensible thing to do.
Yeah, that's nice.
And I also don't use a joule meter. I make them calculate the energy using an ammeter and a voltmeter and using the equation.
And so what sort of power are you putting out? I imagine it's a 12-volt heater, so not, wouldn't it melt it really quick if you put it on 12 volts? No.
It's not that quick. It takes a good 6 or 7 minutes for all of the ice to have melted.
Okay, so you have it on 12 volts, pretty hot. And
yeah.
Oh, well, that detail is the key. That's excellent. Wow, yeah, I think that's great. I wish I'd done it. I've only seen it. Maybe I use it for revision.
I really love it also as well that, you know, Mary, that you've got, that's a favourite of yours because, you know, is that thing of I've got, it's accuracy, isn't it? I think that's accuracy is the word they use when it's close to the correct value. You know, it's an accurate result with some what looks like quite a Heath Robinson lab experiment. And, you know, people say specific heat capacity experiments are boring on this. So they're thinking, no, this is great. This is really interesting stuff because this sort of thing, you know, how does water warm? Oh, what possible use could that be in the current world climate? You know, things like that. Yeah, of course, this is like, you know, core fundamental physics. And when people get ever so cynical about the whole thing of all these things that they learn, I always think, yes, of course, this is a great experiment because this helps us to understand, you know, really fundamental things about our weather systems, the world we live in, how machines work, all this sort of stuff. You know, it's fundamental. I do love it to give it that context always as well, you know, just to say that's why we're doing this.
Well, with specific
heat capacity boring, pa.
Well, I like to make sure the blocks are really covered so they don't know which metal they've got, and then they have to choose from the table which metal they think they've got after they've done all their calculations. Then they can see how accurate they've been. Because if none of their numbers are going
that's
well...
That's cheeky. You don't let them know which metal they're doing in the specific heat capacity.
No, until they've calculated it, then they have to tell me which metal they think they've got.
I'm going to steal that as well. That's great.
That's a good one, isn't it?
I tell you, I really like specific heat capacity for the same reasons that you do, because it looks dull, but you can get such good results. Like a block of ice into a glass of water, and what will the final temperature be? If you know the temperature of your freezer, you can tell it the exact degree it'll be at the end just by calculation, and you just leave it there with the data logger while you teach the lesson, and they work it out. Love that.
I'm not sure I follow that one.
You just have the ice cube, you put it in a glass of water, and you say, mm-hmm. What will the final temperature be?
Oh, I see, yeah, got you. Yes,
you say,
yes,
my
yes,
freezer's
yes.
at minus 20, the water is 20 degrees, then we've got 100 grams of water, and we've got 15 grams of ice. What will the final temperature be?
Yeah, I used to quite like one similar sort of principle. It was on the old A-level spec, the old OCRB spec, which was the one where you worked out the temperature of a Bunsen flame by heating a big kind of steel nut or bolt or some large piece of steel. You'd heat that in the Bunsen flame and then drop it into 500 mils of water and work out the temperature change in the water, and then work your way back, because you knew the specific heat capacity of water and you knew the specific heat capacity of steel. You could work back to what the temperature of the Bunsen flame had to be, which was quite nice.
You told me about that, and I tried that this year, and we got wildly varying results. I don't think Mary would have been very happy with the precision.
Well, yeah, maybe. Sorry, Mary. I feel I should apologise now.
It was great fun, though.
Yes, it's quite good. I think that's the thing, you've got to avoid too much of it turning to steam, haven't you? So you need quite a large amount of water, but not so large that you don't get a decent temperature change.
Oh, so I think we probably talked enough. We just need to do the tidying up at the end of the episode. Are you happy with your T-shirt, Mary?
Yes, thank you. It still fits. So.
It didn't shrink in the wash because it was such a high-quality garment.
So if you want a high-quality physics teaching podcast T-shirt, You can go to the website, the.physicsteachingpodcast.com/shop. And though you can still order vacuum cannons. We've had a couple of orders now. And I will be shipping them at the end of October.
Lovely. The vacuum cannons are on their way. Have you got a vacuum cannon yet to go with your T-shirt, Mary?
I haven't. Are you going to send me one for free?
What's that? What did you say? Did she? I think she just used the F word. Oh, my goodness. The F word on the podcast. Free. Ah!
Well, I'll tell you what, Mary. I promise you, if we ever become profitable, you will have the first free vacuum cannon.
Oh, thank you. I mean, you could just send me the instructions and I'll make one myself. It's fine.
Well, it's all on the website. If you look on the website, there's a blog. It probably is cheaper for you to buy one than get all the parts, I'd say. So, yes, get your T-shirts or a vacuum cannon at the Physics Teaching Podcast shop. Now, we have been asking for people to tell us the ways they teach ionising radiation. And guess what? I don't think anyone does teach ionising radiation. And no one has got any ideas because another week has gone by without anyone tweeting hashtag TPTPIR. So I'm not sure whether we're going to change the subject, Robin, or give one last call for people to tell us how do you teach ionising radiation.
Yeah, so do come along. Yeah, if you've got, I mean, and to be honest, yeah, it is one of those subjects. The reason we picked it for a podcast because it is one of those subjects that strikes fear into the heart of even the most passionate physics teacher, because it can be really, really dry, and you've only got the demos to work with for the radio access sources, and you've got a lot of content to get over, and you've got dangers and all of the different characteristics of the radiation and things like that. So how do you do it? How do you make that live? Because our poor colleagues who are called on to teach physics, those heroes who come into the physics lab and teach physics when they wouldn't necessarily call themselves physics teachers, those folk, you know, give them some help, give them some tips. It's hashtag TPTPIR.
On Twitter, or there's @physics_teaching_podcast on Instagram, or just email us contact@thephysicsteachingpodcast.com, or go to the website, the.physicsteachingpodcast.com, and every page has a contact form at the bottom.
Lovely.
There we go. So let's wind it up there. Mary, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on board. Thank you very much for your practical memoriam and for your advice to Charlie.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you to you, Robin. Speak to you next week.
Thank you, Thomas.
Thank you for listening to the Physics Teaching Podcast with Robin and Thomas. Special thanks today to Mary Wilde and, of course, Charlie Gilbank. Please, we're sure you teach ionising radiation, but no one knows any top tips, so share them with us, Twitter @PhysicsTP, or email us contact@thephysicsteachingpodcast.com. The podcast is produced and edited by me, Thomas WP. Thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you next week.